Oregon Days of Culture.
Get that changed and get the Corgi Walk and the Pearl changed to a date that's not the same as the Multnomah Village Parade.
You know, Dan, it's goddamn.
Could you? Corgi Walk is on like the second Saturday in August or something like that. Yeah. It would probably be easier to ask the Corgi Walk to change the
Right. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to the October 2nd meeting of the Portland City Council. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Bish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. We're going to begin with a proclamation, and Commissioner Fish is ready.
Thank you, Mayor. Kimberly Harrow, would you please come forward? From the Oregon Cultural Trust. And it's my honor to read a proclamation issued by the mayor today, and then Kimberly, we're going to recognize you and ask you to say a few words.
Thank you.
Whereas culture draws us together in common purpose, understanding, and celebration, and whereas Oregon's 1,300 arts, heritage, and humanities nonprofits, museums, libraries, theaters, historical societies, art centers, and heritage sites are the hearts of our community, and whereas the Oregon Cultural Trust presents Oregon Days of Culture, October 1 through October 8, during National Arts and Humanities Month, to encourage Oregonians to celebrate, participate, and give to Oregon culture, and whereas Oregon Days of Culture celebrates the vibrancy of the arts, heritage, and humanities in Oregon, whereas the Oregon Cultural Trust is a product of smart and innovative public policy, and an example of what makes Oregon a proud thought leader nationwide. And whereas supporting cultural nonprofits and the Oregon Cultural Trust is vital to preserving our past, sustaining the present, and creating the future. Now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 1 through October 8, 2013, to be Oregon Days of Culture in Portland, and to call upon all Portlanders to participate in Oregon culture, to celebrate its vibrancy and depth, and to help ensure the future vitality of the arts, heritage, and humanity organizations. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This celebration of
Kimberly,
Oregon.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Kimberly Howard. I'm the trust manager of the Oregon Cultural Trust. This year's celebration of Oregon Days of Culture will be centered on the Oregon Culture Field Guide, which is online and available at our website at culturaltrust.org. It is a celebration and highlighting of activities that happen year-round, and we're encouraging and inviting Oregonians to create life lists of activities here in the richness of our state that encompass the arts, heritage, and humanities, and check those activities off throughout the year. For those of you who are not familiar, the Oregon Cultural Trust champions culture in our state and enriches our lives by supporting, investing in arts, heritage, and humanities organization in all 36 counties and the 9 federally recognized tribes. It is the only one of its kind in the country, and it's actually a treasure that makes me proud to be an Oregonian. The Trust has awarded over 1,000 grants totaling $14 million since 2003 and has built a permanent endowment that now stands more than $18 million. That ensures that future generations can have the same Oregon experience that we are fortunate to enjoy today. Oregonians who give to any of the 1,300 cultural nonprofits that Commissioner Fish mentioned, that was mentioned on the proclamation by Mayor Hales, can receive a generous state tax credit if they make a matching contribution to the trust. It's as simple as donate, match, get the whole match back. Our goal is to raise more than $4 million this year to expand our support to worthy organizations. We've recently created a Pioneer Circle program for passionate supporters who give above the tax credit. To learn more about the Oregon Cultural Trust and to donate, you can go to culturaltrust.org or contact us. We love to talk about it. I want to reiterate the fact that it is very easy. In fact, you'll hear later on from an organization that Work for Art here in Portland, and you can actually, by giving to Work for Art, that qualifies as well for the giving a gift to the Cultural Trust and getting the Cultural Trust donation back dollar for dollar when you file your taxes. Commissioner Fish, have I sufficiently given the plug?
You've done a great job, and since everybody that I know still has stumbles when we start talking about a tax credit, I just want to highlight again how this works. So I use the Willamette Week Give Guide end of the year because I'm a procrastinator, and I go online, and they list lots of nonprofits that I care about. And I'll make a contribution online to each of those nonprofits, and then it tells me how much I can contribute to the Oregon Cultural Trust as a match that I'll get right back on my taxes.
Absolutely.
So let's say that I want to focus on organizations that do writing, jazz, and maybe theater. I make my contributions to those nonprofits for which I get a deduction on my taxes. But if I match that contribution, say $400, to the Oregon Cultural Trust, when I file my state tax return, I get a tax credit of $400, meaning dollar for dollar, the Oregon sends me back a check for every dollar that I have given to nonprofits. It's unique.
Exactly.
It allows us to, in effect, direct our dollars and magnify our impact. And I urge people to participate because the other key to this program is that we're supporting arts, culture, heritage statewide.
Absolutely.
These dollars don't just stay in our community. They benefit the whole community. And in fact, Oregon, Portland arts-based organizations that get funding, often as a condition of the funding, have to take their programs out to rural areas, bring music and dance and theater and the arts to places throughout our community. So it's a wonderful program. It doesn't cost you anything if you seek the tax credit every year on your state tax return, but it is a way we build an endowment to support the arts. And in this proclamation, it notes that we are home to all these wonderful organizations. And let us not forget that today, all of our federal partners, all the museums, all of the things that we partner with, they're all closed. They are a consequence of this shutdown. And if you're in Washington, D.C. today on the Mall, you cannot go to the Smithsonian. And you cannot see art and treasures of American history. And you cannot see relics from the past. But in Oregon, they're open. And they're open in part because of something called the Oregon Cultural Trust. Congratulations for all your great work.
Thank you. Thank you very much for letting
us
be here today.
Well done. Thanks.
Here's the proclamation.
Thanks, Kimberly. This is a really important part of what makes Portland, Portland. And we appreciate the good work that all our arts organizations do, that you, Commissioner Fish, and the Regional Arts and Culture Commission do to keep these ideas in front of our community, to keep these opportunities for making a difference in front of each of us as citizens and contributors. So thank you so much for all that you're doing. As a Portlander, as a beneficiary of these opportunities, it's a great part of what life here is about. I spent a little time this week enjoying the arts scene here in Portland, saw the great artist rep performance of The Big Meal on Sunday. I have a personal bias in that my son's in the cast, but it was a great performance. I'm going to see some of what our community has to offer in the art galleries this week. Tori Breyer is opening a show tonight. So there's a lot going on in Portland any given day, any given weekend, any given night, and it's because we have these great organizations that are supported by philanthropists, large and small. So what we do through the Cultural Trust and the tax credit, pretty important, especially in light of our inconsistent federal partner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you all. We're going to move on to communications items. We have a number of them here this morning. 926 is the first. Carla?
Request of Mike Kiba to address council regarding labor relations.
Mike, come on up. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just have to, if you haven't been here in a while, you just put your name in the record and you've got 3 minutes.
All right. Welcome. Thank you. Commissioners, Mr. Mayor, thank you for your time. I'm Mike Kiba. I've been a painter with Portland Parks and Recreation for 12 years, and I'm a member of the District Council of Trade Unions bargaining team. The members of the District Council of Trade Unions are involved in virtually every aspect of city government. We bring clean water to your tap and process it when it leaves to protect our rivers. We fix your streets, sidewalks, bikeways, and bridges to keep families safe on the road. We maintain police bureau records and accurately track evidence for the prosecution of crimes. We maintain your gold medal park system. We are the first responders during weather emergencies like heavy flooding. The DCTU protects our communities and maintains the quality of life we all enjoy. In the spring, we, the community, came to voice our support for the programs that were important to us during the $25 million budget crisis. And we, the city workers, came to advocate for the services that we provide. In 1996, the DCTU represented 2,000 members delivering frontline services. We have been depleted to 1,600 members. Recently, the new budget office reported ending the fiscal year with an $11 million surplus linked in part to staff layoffs, yet this has not prompted a conversation about restoring the staffing levels. We also discovered in 2012 the City of Portland spent $2.1 million to fund management city leave, which rewarded staff, 868 staff, with up to 10 additional vacation days with little or no justification for the bonus. That's equivalent to 21 DCTU positions. All this while we fight for our cost of living. Gloria Steinem said, if you want to know somebody's values, don't listen to what they say, look at their checkbook. What does your checkbook say about your values? In our bargaining sessions, we have fought to maintain contract language that says, any work which is performed by bargaining unit employees shall not be contracted out until the city indicates that the contracting out will result in reduced costs. Reducing costs is the basic endeavor of any organization, whether public or private, and this language is our guarantee to you that we provide the best work at the best cost. This language helps safeguard the taxpayers' money, and it makes good business sense. We are left to ask why the city management is fighting to remove this language that holds managers accountable for tax dollars they spend. Is it to open the door for crony contracts to friends and relatives? Is it to silence opposition to corruption like Ellis McCoy parking meter scandal, which this language helped to expose? Or is it to grease the skids for politicians to give away no-bid contracts to pay back political favors? But what do I know? I'm just a mere humble painter. Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm here today to ask you, what commitment can we get from you today to ensure that this article stays intact to protect the taxpayers' investment?
All right, thanks for coming. Now, you know we're not going to bargain in this room, but we appreciate you coming here and advocating. So thanks for being here. Thanks. Thanks, everybody. Okay, next.
Item 927, request of Kurt French to address council regarding labor relations.
Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning. My name is Kurt French. I'm a 26-year employee of the City of Portland in BDS. I'm a member of AFSCME 189, a steward, and a chapter chair. I'm on the bargaining team for the second time. We still do not have a contract that can be taken to the DCTU membership to vote for ratification. To that end, the Portland Firefighters Association and the Northwest Oregon Labor Council took a resolution to the recent Oregon AFL-CIO Biennial Convention. That resolution, support workers of the District Council of Trade Unions. Whereas the District Council of Trade Unions, DCTU, a partnership of unions, represents 1,600 of the best trained, most dedicated workers of the City of Portland, Oregon, and whereas the DCTU provides essential services to the citizens of Portland, and whereas the unions have been negotiating in good faith for over 7 months with the City of Portland, with no resolution in sight, and their benefits and important contract language under attack, and whereas the City of Portland is attempting to remove critical language regarding subcontracting and seniority, now, therefore, be it resolved that the delegates of the Oregon AFL-CIO extend their support to the DCTU workers as they proceed through negotiations, and be it further resolved that the Oregon AFL-CIO recommend to its affiliates and allies to support actions as and when requested by the DCTU. And now be it finally resolved that the Oregon AFL-CIO Executive Council send a letter to all sitting commissioners and the mayor of the City of Portland in support of the DCTU workers and their contracts. This resolution was endorsed by the Oregon AFL-CIO, which represents over 108,000 members. It has also been endorsed by the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council. At that same convention, the DCTU took around a petition getting signatures of members of the AFL-CIO in support of the District Council of Trade Unions. What we need now is a contract that can be taken to the DCTU membership and ratified. We have been negotiating since spring with a union with a city bargaining team that has typically had a response of just no, or it doesn't meet our interests, or a changing rationale for why they would not accept union proposals. We need an honest negotiator across the table. We don't need punitive proposals like a first time ever, a colon, not retroactive to July 1. This has never happened before. Doesn't need to happen now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Thank you. All right, Carla, next one, please.
Item 928. Request of Sam Sachs to address council regarding recognition of Sam. Park rangers.
Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Mayor Hales, Commissioner Fritz, members of the council, thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. My name is Sam Sachs. I'm a park ranger for the City of Portland. I've been a park ranger for almost 4 years, first as a seasonal, and for the last year and a half working full-time. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of all Portland Park Rangers. We speak as one and we stand together, united. All rangers have reviewed my testimony and support its contents. I'd like to share a story with you about a fellow park ranger, Dustin Meyer, who is over here to my right. Last week while on patrol, he discovered a three-year-old boy alone on the Springwater Corridor. The boy had wandered away from his home while his mom was shopping. His dad was asleep at home. After Ranger Meyer discovered the boy, he contacted the police and with their help, able to locate the boy's home and contact his parents. If not for Ranger Meyer's quick actions, it's possible the boy could have met a much worse fate. The Park Ranger program is a tremendous service to the community. The lost child is at home with his family today because Dustin was there to help. Unfortunately, Dustin won't be on the job much longer. He is classified as a seasonal ranger and his hours are about to run out at the end of this month. Today we have 7 full-time rangers and about 17 seasonal rangers. The seasonal rangers come to work and do the same job that I do as a full-time, take the same risks I do, dealing with violent individuals who at times threaten physical violence. In fact, some of the seasonal rangers are at a greater risk when they work alone at night in the dark, locking restrooms. All of this for between $12 to $13 an hour with no health care benefits, no sick days, and no job security. Working alone at night is just one example of the avoidable risks we have been forced to take. We can only hope that we do not see another ranger violently attacked and injured as Ranger Ayers was when he was thrown 75 feet off a cliff in Forest Park. I'm here today for a few reasons. We met with you, Mayor Hales, in March to discuss our reasons for organizing and to demonstrate to you a unanimous support among rangers for joining LIUNA 483. 6 months later, we are still waiting to be recognized. While our management team continues to give us added responsibilities outside the scope of our job, like parking enforcement duties in Washington Park and water security responsibilities, we are aware of the Ask Me grievance regarding the parking enforcement duties. We want to be on record today that we neither support, endorse, or were consulted on these added job duties. The park rangers support the grievance by parking enforcement. We continue to have little or no say in our work conditions, and yet every time we raise a reasonable concern with management about our jobs, like schedule changes, class comp review, or shift differential, we are told that these are issues that will be dealt with in bargaining, as if to say the city believes our unionization is inevitable, while at the same time the city attorneys works to put roadblocks and prevent us from becoming a union. We could have easily unionized by now had we chose to leave the seasonals and Dustin behind. But we've all been seasonal workers before, seasonal rangers, and we stand united with them today as strong as we did 6 months ago. We ask you put on hold the implementation of the Washington Park enforcement piece until the Ask Me grievance can be heard. It's not the park rangers' desire to take union jobs away from union members and give them to non-represented workers at a lower rate. We ask you again to reconsider recognizing us, the park rangers, as part of LIONA 483. By doing so, you will empower us to and give validity to the work we have done over the past 2 years to build this program to what it is today. At the very basic core, Mayor, park rangers want what everyone in this room wants, to be valued at work, to have our pay commensurate with our job duties, to have a say in something as simple as what shift we work, and to be consulted on changes in our job duties. We want to have a voice. By recognizing us, Mayor, you can give us that voice. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you all. We have a couple more. Carla?
Item 929, request of Carol Morse to address council regarding participation in donating to Work for Art.
And I think one more coming up with her.
And 930, request of Mike Golub to address council regarding participation in donating to Work for Art.
Morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Same procedure. Just put your name in the record, and you've got 3 minutes.
My name's Carol Morse. I live in Northwest Portland, and I work for Portland General Electric. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners, and thank you for letting Mike and I be here. We are kind of an unlikely duo, because when he talks sports to me, I don't know what to do, but we do talk arts and culture together, so that really works. I'm here today because Work for Art is a choice in the City of Portland's charitable campaign, which I understand kicks off October 16th. Work for Art will be one of 15 groups that are featured during your campaign. Up until now, the City of Portland employees have given about $86,000 in donations to Work for Art during the past 7 years, which gets matched by the Work for Art Matching Challenge Fund. Thank you very much for participating in that and giving your ongoing donation to that fund, so that your city employees' $86,000 resulted in about $172,000 that went out to arts and culture organizations in the region. I'm here because at Portland General Electric, this has been and has become an iconic part of our campaign. We're in the midst of it right now. And we have 2,700 employees. We also really do well each year. About 66% of our employees give during the campaign. And they give to, a couple hundred different nonprofits. It's an open campaign. But I'm really proud to say that Work for Art has grown over the years and has become the number two campaign at our company. And what is especially interesting about that is it's sandwiched in between Oregon Food Bank, which is the number one recipient, and Dornbecker Children's Hospital, which is number three, so that our employees, even at the electric company, see the value of the arts along with food and health care. We've also been the number one, our campaign's been the number one campaign in the city for the past 2 years. One of the things that's really important to us at the company is arts education. We really believe that the worker of the future needs to be well-educated in all kinds of things, not just engineering and technology, but in critical problem-solving and innovative thinking, which the arts does. And with the match that we give, the 50% match, you then give the match from the matching fund, and then you get the arts card, which Mike will talk about. One thing I want to do real quickly, Mr. Arts Commissioner, is give you, our campaign is called Give Like a Rock Star, Keep Rocking On. So we use the arts to actually move the whole campaign, and it gives the world tour locations on the back. This is only worth $8, so I think you can accept it. Thank you very much.
Rock star, that would be Nick, yes.
Yeah.
Welcome, Mike.
Good Good morning. I'm Mike Golub. I'm the COO of the Portland Timbers, and I live in Southwest Portland. And we at the Timbers are huge supporters of the Work for Art program. We launched our first campaign last year. And in addition to the obvious benefits of money going directly to the arts organizations, we had some surprising results. We have a young workforce, and for many, this was their first chance of first meaningful charitable giving. And for others, they weren't really aware and weren't real users of the amazing array of arts that we have in the community. And this arts card that Carol alluded to, for $60 a year, whoever they get an arts card that has an array of discounts throughout the year at a wide variety of arts institutions. And so for our young people, they learned how to give, and they were exposed to the arts. And it's a wonderful byproduct of the program. The program, Work for Art, has been in existence for 7 years and has had a remarkable success. There has been a great collective effort that have raised $4.7 million over the last 7 years. 55% of that has come from private donations, and 45% has come from the Matching Challenge Fund. And as Carol mentioned, there are nine entities, public and private, that comprise the Matching Fund. The City of Portland is the biggest one. But the Matching Fund is a huge impetus, incentive, and catalyst for the more than 5,000 donors to the Work for Art program that represent over 75 companies throughout our region. Yesterday, Mayor Hales and I were among the more than 600 attendees at the Greater Portland Economic Summit, and there was, you might imagine, at an economic summit, there was a lot of discussion about key sectors in our community and job creation. Well, the arts and culture sector represents more than 8,500 jobs in our community, and the Work for Art program is a way to keep those arts institutions thriving and viable and those 8,500 people employed. So on behalf of the Timbers and joining PGE and behalf of the more than 70 companies not here today who proudly support the Work for Art program, we would encourage the city and city workers to vigorously support Work for Art during the Capital Your Charity campaign.
Here, can I just make one comment? Yeah. First, I want to thank our two honored guests for serving on the Work for Art cabinet and for being such tireless advocates. I also want to thank city employees that have year after year chosen to contribute to Work for Art. Employees every year have a range of options, but those that do support it have it deducted automatically from their paycheck, people like me, and the money then goes into this worthy cause. And so I'm grateful that our employees every year have said this is an important cause, and they want the option to donate to it. But the third thing I just want to say kind of sticks in my craw is the last meeting we had, Tom Hughes issued a challenge. And it's kind of like bothered me a little bit because of, the tension in the ranks. But he issued a challenge, and he said that he would like to see the elected officials at the county, at Metro, and the city all sign up and participate. Even if they give a dollar, he wants to see 100% participation. So I've taken up that challenge. I have a little bit of work to do, but I'm hoping that the next time you're here, I can tell you that 100% of the electeds in this building have chosen voluntarily to make a contribution so that Tom doesn't get the last word on that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for what you do, and thanks for supporting arts in our community.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, it sounds like we better make sure that you don't have to eat any crow, not to talk bad about birds.
Birds, yeah, really.
Thank you very much. Nice
thank
job.
Thank you.
Eloise.
Okay. Thank you, Nick. Now, let's move to the consent calendar. I don't think there are any requests to pull anything off the consent calendar. Is that right?
Correct. I do not have any.
Okay. Unless there are any now, then roll call on the consent calendar, please.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. And time certain, 9:31.
Encourage the exploration and incorporation of bird-friendly design and practices in city plans and policies.
Mr. Saltzman.
Well, thank you, Mayor, members of the council. As Portlanders, I think we all see much to admire about birds. After all, they can fly, and who among us wouldn't want to do that? I also admire how the birds who don't migrate south for the winter survive. Their survival and skills are really amazing to me as well. But right now, we are in the midst of what's called the fall migration, when thousands of birds, maybe even millions, make their way to warmer climates in the south. And in light of the fall migration, I'm very pleased to bring forward this resolution to encourage and support bird-friendly building design and management practices. We've recognized that birds on the migration path fly into buildings and will injure themselves, sometimes fatally, because of a building's design. For instance, they may strike a building with reflective glass, or they may be disoriented at night by lit buildings as they are navigating along the migratory path. We have several city documents that reference and include language around bird and habitat-friendly designs, including the draft comprehensive plan and the draft central city plan for 2035. Both plans are in the works right now, headed our way soon. This resolution serves as a focal point to those documents and brings those interests, those intents, into one place. I would also note that in July of 2012, the city produced a resource guide for bird-friendly building design, a step in the right direction. As I said, this resolution serves as a focal point to bring all those documents and those intents into one place, but it's also about bringing awareness to building owners and property managers, and that includes homeowners. Unfortunately, bird strikes can happen at residential properties, as they have at my own house many times. So today we're going to hear from some experts who will share their experience and tips for making your property bird friendly. So I'd like to introduce Alan Armstrong with MWA Architects, if you could come on up here, and then Bob Salinger with Portland Audubon Society. Welcome. And why don't you go ahead and start, Alan, if you're ready to go.
I think so.
Okay.
I find this one image. All right, good morning, Mr.
Morning.
Mayor and commissioners. Thanks for having me, Commissioner Saltzman. My name is Alan Armstrong. I work with MWA Architects, and I'm the project architect working with MSA engineers and the Portland Water Bureau on the Fulton Pump Station project. And as some of you might know, it's a pretty complex project. Lots of technical considerations. It's in the 100-year floodplain in Willamette Park, which is kind of a big deal. It's a 100-year building, and we want it to last for a long time as it serves a critical need for our community. It's in a beloved park. We've had extreme public involvement, and it's been through the design review process. So there's a lot of design input from a lot of stakeholders. And if you can see this image projected, this is the design we come up with. And because of and or despite of all of this design input, we feel like we've come up with a compelling concept for the building. And part of that concept is some windows. And these windows are included to provide daylight to the maintenance personnel inside the building, but also provide a glimpse of the function of the building to passersby. Problem is, as soon as we have windows on the building, we create a problem with bird collisions. And it was actually Portland Parks and Rec and a member of our public advisory committee, Jeannie Galick, who brought this to our attention. And the Water Bureau and the design team and all the other stakeholders, of course, immediately were on board with addressing this problem. So I want to run through a few of the specific things that we've done for this design to mitigate bird collisions. First of all, we used the newly created bird-friendly design guidelines from the Audubon Society as a reference. It's a pretty great document and pretty comprehensive. And I also worked directly with Candace Larson at the Audubon Society to make sure we were covering all our bases with the design. One thing we did to address bird collision deterrence was Mike Ross at the Portland Water Bureau did a see if I get this right, bird collision threat rating calculation, and that's based on a lead calculation that basically takes the amount of glazing on the building and divides it by the amount of solid facade space, and the glazing is given a rating based on its bird friendly or unfriendliness. And this building has gone through a lot of changes over the course of design, and at 30% design, our bird collision threat rating, or BCTR, was 8.11, and that is within the acceptable range of 15, but the east facade, we had a lot of glazing on that facade, and it was 23.62, so this was unacceptable. Now, moving forward to 60% design, we made a lot of changes, not just for bird-friendly elements, but other design criteria as well. The nice thing is, because of these changes, we redid the calculation. Our BCTR is now 0.65 and less than 1 on all facades. So this was a great change for the building itself, building design itself, but also for bird collision deterrence. The other main thing we've done, and this, if you read the bird-friendly design guidelines, this is the most effective way of deterring bird collisions, is to treat the exterior surface of the glass with a pattern that disrupts the reflectiveness of the glass. And that can be accomplished in many ways. But the key is to conform to the 2x4 rule, which basically limits the amount of open space that a bird wants to fly through. So if you can get your open space less than 2 inches by 4 inches, then you will limit a lot of bird collisions. And this is an example of a mock-up we did to test. We did a lot of these, and this was the final one. But you can see that the etched or sandblasted, there's, again, many ways to do it, disrupts that reflection and keeps birds from flying into the glass. Let's see here. Lighting. Lighting is very important as well. There's actually very limited exterior lighting on this building, considering that it's a secure facility in a park. And all the lighting is down lighting, so there's no spill upwards into the atmosphere that would draw birds in at night. Interior lighting, this building is not normally staffed, and so lightings are default off. And the only times the interior lighting would be on at night is if there was an emergency. And even then, the design team has designed the lighting so to limit the spill from the exterior to the interior. And then finally, the roof of the building is about 90% covered in eco-roof. So this is bird-friendly in that it provides some habitat for birds. So at the same time we're trying to provide habitat, we also want to prevent birds from running into the building. And just in closing, I just want to make a couple key points. And that is, as a design professional, 3 years ago when I started working on this project, I was pretty unaware of this issue. And going through this process, I've learned a lot. And the numbers are pretty staggering as far as bird collisions, bird fatalities due to building collisions in our country per year. And so I've come to realize that this is a very important issue for design professionals, especially important Portland, like you said, being on the Pacific Flyway. And we have easy and direct effect on this this issue as well. By making simple changes to our building design, we can prevent bird collisions. And those changes, those design decisions, don't have to be standalone. For instance, the fritting on the glass helps with some occupant comfort issues, reducing glare. It can help reduce energy costs by limiting the solar heat gain into the building. So there's some synergy between bird-friendly design and other design criteria. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Alan. Bob?
Good morning, Mayor Hales and members of the City Council. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society. I'm going to turn the bulk of my time over to Mary Coolidge, who also worked for Audubon. I just wanted to say some quick thank yous, first of all, to Commissioner Saltzman for bringing this forward and for the city for all their work on this. This is an important thing, as Alan has already said. These numbers are staggering. This is considered to be one of the top two or three killers of birds in the United States, in North America. Estimates are from anywhere from 100 million birds a year to several hundred million. Some estimates even put it as high as a billion. So the numbers are absolutely staggering. If we're concerned about protecting and preserving biodiversity, especially among bird populations, windows are a place that we have to be thinking about. So this is an important step forward. And I would say a lot of cities have already taken this step. We're not unique here. Chicago, Toronto, Houston have adopted San Francisco, a lot of cities have adopted very, very strong programs, recognizing that this is a very significant program or problem. Some people ask, you know, why do this? Why is the city worried about this? My question would be, why not? We want to be ecologically sustainable. It's something Portland prides itself on. And this is something we can do. It's a voluntary program. It's a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of understanding how we impact the environment around us and incorporating these kinds of principles in. So it's just a smart thing to do. And as Alan has already noted, a lot of synchronicity with saving energy, with other goals as well, preserving our ability to see the night sky. There's a lot of overlap with other valuable things that we're trying to do in our urban landscape. So it's a smart thing to do. It's a green thing to do. It's a thing that can save us money. It's a thing that can save birds. So some quick thank yous. First of all, you know, a lot of people worked on this. I want to thank the city, Roberta Jortner from planning, and Sue Thomas from Parks were instrumental. Bureau of Development Services wasn't super directly involved, but we did keep in communication with them throughout to make sure that they were on board. This was funded by National Audubon Society and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also participated. American Bird Conservancy provided some of the preliminary materials on which this is based. And then there was a cast of dozens of people from local architecture firms, Port of Vancouver, local architects, just a huge number of people that came in and served on an advisory committee. So we really wanted to work with the whole community to make sure this was something that was useful, acceptable, state-of-the-art, functional. And so, you know, we're very pleased that we were able to work with the local business community to make sure this was something that was going to be useful. And we got a lot of support for it. Who else? Jeannie Galick, who did the design. And then most of all, I want to thank Mary Coolidge, who was on our staff at the time. She's since moved on. She's now up on Bonnie Butte. She came down from the rainstorms where she was counting hawks. But this was her project, and she really did a tremendous amount of work to put this together and really deserves kudos for that. And she'll talk a little more about the specifics. So the last thing I would say is, you know, I hope this is a first step, not a last step. We've done the work to put this together. Passing a resolution, I hope, today to support it, and getting it into city plans, getting it out in front of people, making it part of the things we think about when we build and rebuild our landscape is really where it's at, you know, affecting change on the ground. And we're already seeing that happen. This is a great case in point. We're very excited about it. Lewis and Clark has made changes at their law school. University of Portland talked about incorporating this in when they build on the bluff. So we're starting to see folks really embrace this. We want to get a groundswell, both bird-friendly building design in the building phase, and then also getting folks to turn out lights that are unnecessary that are on at night. We're not talking about safety issues. We're not trying to infringe upon those. But light pollution, when we're shining lights up into the sky, when we have superfluous lighting, it's a matter of energy efficiency. It's a matter of seeing the night sky. It's a matter of protecting our wildlife. So that I want to turn it over to Mary.
Bob, can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
You know, years ago when the whole green building movement started and people tried to caricature it, the thing that I think people were slow to realize is that there were long-term savings of going green building. That if you made a fully sustainable building, you keep your energy costs down over time, and there was a return on investment case to be made. We're now obviously talking about how to make buildings more resilient, anticipating things like earthquakes and other natural disasters.
Right.
Now you're talking to us about how to make buildings more bird-friendly. What do you say to a property owner? This is a voluntary program. What do you say to a private property owner to make the case as to why it's in their long-term economic self-interest to invest in this kind of this approach?
That's a great question, and it's an important question. I think the exciting news is that this correlates very, very well with money savings. The types of strategies we're talking about are things that are already being done through LEED certification, through energy efficiency programs. And so it's a matter of tweaking those. It's not necessarily something you're doing on top of everything else. It's a matter of looking at how you're doing your energy efficiency and your construction and design in ways that incorporate in some of the principles here. So a lot of what we're talking about here isn't necessarily additive. It's just transformative in terms of thinking about how do you do the fritting on your glass? How do you do the shading above your glass? How do you juxtapose your glass with natural features on the landscape? These are things that we're already embracing and thinking about because they make economic sense. And these kinds of strategies that we're talking about here, fit incredibly well with that. In some cases, they really enhance it. So this is an economical thing to do in the vast majority of cases. It's really just a matter of getting that information out in front of people. You're going to save energy. You're going to save birds. And, you know, in some cases, you're going to preserve our ability to see the sky and, you know, make our community more livable. It's all upside, really, from a biodiversity and an economic perspective.
Thank you.
Mary?
Mayor Hales, commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. This is a really exciting day for those of us who worked on putting this resource guide together. The resolution that you're bringing forward today helps to address what is emerging as one of the major conservation issues facing birds today. And let's see if I can get this going. So research has demonstrated that up to a billion birds die every year in the United States alone as a result of hitting windows. And one of the reasons why this is a very critical issue is because it's an indiscriminate killer. So common birds, rare birds, adult birds, juveniles, healthy, unhealthy birds hit as readily as any other. So it's really culling some of the healthiest birds out of the population, which is a problem. We didn't know prior to 2008 whether we had a window strike issue in the city of Portland. Nobody had ever evaluated this. So we ran a pilot survey in 2009 and then followed up with four additional seasons of monitoring. It was a tiny sample size. We were looking at 21 buildings in the downtown core. During that time, we picked up about 40 to 65 birds per season. And we documented 36 native species of birds. During that same time, the Wildlife Care Center at Audubon documented 83 species of native birds and fielded phone calls and intakes in the number of 200 to 300 per year. So really, this is a pretty significant issue. The bird species that we found when we were doing our surveys was not what you would consider typical urban core species. Crows and jays and house sparrows. Really, it was a list of warblers and hummingbirds and woodpeckers and sparrows, a pretty staggering toll that it was taking on our diversity. And the very basic problem is that transparency and reflections create habitat mirages that birds have difficulty distinguishing from reality. So the solution is to essentially do anything to interrupt reflections and to treat transparent areas of window glass. That can be accomplished with UV-patterned glass, etching, fritting, translucence, and really as little as 5% of a window surface can be treated and still be 90% effective in reducing window strikes. There's a lot of research that's going into the minimum amount of marking on a window that will still produce effective results. As Alan mentioned and Bob also mentioned, there's...
Can I ask you just one question? Yep. At night, when a building is lit, do we have the same risk factors for birds, or is it generally, is the greatest risk during daylight hours?
Yeah, it's a different risk factor at night, but they are related. So artificial lighting in the city lures birds in because they're photophilic. They're drawn to lit areas. And we didn't document that we had an overnight strike issue in Portland. We may. More research would really be necessary. But in general, what we documented was that probably birds are being lured into the city overnight because of artificial lighting. And then when they start foraging early the next day, that's when they're running into reflections. So it is a related issue. So as Alan and Bob mentioned, there's good news. The synergies are great news. So reducing solar heat gain, as demonstrated here on the OHSU Center for Health and Healing in the upper right-hand corner, and the federal building with the solar panels on the exterior of the building, those are great synergistic ways to mark a building for birds. And then branding, carrying aesthetics through a building, creating privacy in some cases, reducing vandalism, marking of windows on bus shelters has been demonstrated to reduce vandalism. And when Portland introduces this resolution, they really join, we join a growing list of cutting-edge cities that are already doing this kind of work. Some of them in the voluntary capacity, some of them mandatory, and some of them combined, like in San Francisco's bird-friendly building guidelines. The last critical element that we've already touched on a little bit is emphasizing a lights-out program. So anything to reduce unnecessary overnight lighting, including shielding light fixtures, eliminating uplighting and spotlights, eliminating vanity lighting, minimizing light spill from the interior of a building. And really, this saves energy. It preserves the night sky for stargazing. It saves money for building owners. And it helps preserve our biodiversity, which I think many of us would argue is part of Portland's livability. Lights out programs are already going on in many other North American cities, including some pretty big municipalities. So Portland would be joining this list of cutting edge cities that are already working on this kind of preservation of birds and reducing of some of the critical elements that they're facing as they live in our city year round and also migrate through our city.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The last thing I just want to add, I just want to acknowledge Roberta, who's sitting behind us, because Roberta was really a key member of the team, too, and did a tremendous amount of work. And I mentioned earlier, but I just wanted to, since she's sitting here, I wanted to really point her out, too, because city staff were critical to this, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Just a semi-technical question. I mean, this is a teachable moment for me, and I suspect for others, just to learn that this research and this set of practices are evolving together. So do we know anything about the color of light and its effect? In other words, is there any difference? You know, humans perceive red light at night very differently than white light, and it affects our ability, our night vision. Do we know anything about that subject of if people used a different part of the spectrum in terms of the lights that are used on buildings, would it make a difference? Do we know?
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on in that particular field, in part because of art light installations, in part because of at-sea drilling and those platforms that have red lights. So red and white lights are the most attractive and ultimately the most dangerous for birds. Mm. Blue and green are considerably less attractive and therefore safer. That's a gross simplification of that answer. Yeah.
Okay. Because we could start to make changes in just what people use for lamping their buildings or their exterior lighting, if we knew what would make a difference. So, thank you.
Any further questions?
This is sort of an aside, but Bob, how many birds do cats kill per year? Do you know?
You know, the numbers are astronomical, is what I always tell folks, because the numbers are always challenged, and whether it's 100 million or 300 million or a billion, we know the numbers are huge. And so we try to address all the different causes of mortality. Cats are usually put up there along with buildings, and the primary cause of bird decline is obviously habitat loss and fragmentation. That's the thing we really need to work on most of all, and we can do that in the city and in our wildlands as well. But we also need to deal with these secondary causes of mortality, you know, and I would actually call them primary, cats, building strikes, pesticides, invasive species. There's a whole slew of things, and we work on all of them. Since you bring up cats, though, one of the things I would say is that Portland is unique in the United States and really anywhere in the fact that our cat advocacy groups and our bird advocacy groups work together. That's a unique feature. I'd love to come back to you and talk to you about that sometime, because we have a very, very close working relationship with the Feral Cat Coalition, and we get invited all over the country to talk about that, because typically it's, Sylvester and Tweety. It's open warfare. We have a completely unique model that I'm really proud of here. And this is also, you know, another unique model. I mean, it's not unique as we've ever heard, but I mean, it's a collaborative model for dealing with some very big challenges. And we were really happy to have the architectural community come to the table and get excited about it and give us some awesome feedback. Likewise, we're working with the CAT folks, too, to address that issue, and real proud of that.
I just wanted to take the opportunity to make a plug for spaying and neutering cats.
Spay, neuter, and keep your cats indoors wherever possible. Keep them safe at home. In fact, we just launched a campaign with the Feral Cat Coalition, Cats Safe at Home. We just did a catio tour where people come out and see how to build an outdoor shelter for your cat. We had over 500 people sign up for that. We did cap it. in its first year because we were overcrowded. Only in Portland would you have to cap, you know, a catio tour. But it's cool. I mean, I think it shows how much people care about wildlife, care about their pets. This is an awesome animal community. And, you know, this is just another cool piece to add to that. But thank you for the comment on cats, because that's important, too.
Well, thank you all. Thanks for all your good work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good work.
And is that in terms of a panel presentation? So yeah. Is anyone else signed up to speak on this?
Yes, we have three people signed up. Please come on up. John, I believe the last name is Freewing, Crystal Ilinski, and Charles Johnson.
Good morning. Welcome.
John Freewing. I'd like to thank Commissioner Saltzman for bringing this resolution forward. But the point I would like to make is not only does it help birds, but night lighting that shows up, is a nuisance to people as well. I have a particular problem with the 7-Eleven site at 21st and Broadway Northeast, where their flood lamp in the parking lot is aimed relatively high and shines directly into my room. I put on blinds and so forth, but he doesn't have $300 to bring a truck out and adjust the lamp. But so I think the resolution should include writing regulations for night lighting in parking lots and public spaces. I was amazed when I looked on the internet that in Oregon there are three cities that have such regulations: Redmond, Sandy, and Kaiser. And when you go to California, it's literally hundreds and hundreds of cities that have regulations against night lighting. It's not only a matter of energy, it's a matter of nuisance for people. The Portland City Code right now regulates off-site lighting at night to a level of one-half of 1 foot candle at the property boundary. And I believe my problem at 21st and Broadway exceeds that, but I've got to get an engineer to certify that and bring it to the city to get some enforcement. So I'd like to have you regulate night lighting, particularly the light that shines up. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks.
Hello. Sorry, I get confused if I don't have the order. We're not seated as we were called. My name is Crystal Ilinski, and I represent 10,000 statistically random Oregonians that care. I asked the cat question too, Commissioner Novick. I was very curious about all of the attacks on our wildlife. And I know I've spoken about this to you before when I came out of basically in the forest to do some ground truthing and to learn how ecosystems work. And we are an ecosystem. There are many cities where wildlife have managed to become very strong, and New York City has been working on that. So I'm surprised that we have problems like this. Usually techno fixes are regulations that weren't really thought through. So if we have problems with the windows, I was just talking to a lady who was here for the union action, and she was saying, you know, she installed the latest, most energy efficient windows and, you know, invested and took the time and did that. And in the 30 years she lived there, she could witness how big an increase it was of dead birds. I mean, birds hitting the window. So who designs these things? But it makes me think that, you know, about a lot of issues in our town, in our state, about permitting, licenses, and the standards that we have. I want to mention that where I live, I'm very afraid of the coal trains coming through. We have a lot of parks around there, and we go bird watching, and it's beautiful. There's a lot of issues we'll have with all sorts of pollution. I can't imagine the birds in Milwaukee are real happy with the precision cast parts. But another anecdote is the Fred Meyer. You were speaking of the 7-Eleven, but the Fred Meyer up on Gleason and 60th, it shines. It has so many lights down into the neighborhood of the lower Mount Tabor. And there's a lot of parks there, too. And people say, you know, it's just striking them right in their windows, but imagine what it does to wildlife. So Gosh, I don't have much time, but I was going to give you another anecdote, but I think you get the point that I'm really actually impressed by this office and what they've done, and